This is the British Broadcasting Corporation. We present London Forum, a weekly program in which we bring to the microphone prominent personalities to discuss important topics of the day. Here is John Connell to introduce the speakers.
This is John Connell introducing this week's London Forum. Our subject we're talking about this week is the role of the press. And as we're talking mainly about the United Kingdom press and the press of the United States, we've got here four very distinguished journalists, two Americans and two British. Going on from my left, Mr. Raymond Daniel, chief of the London Bureau of the New York Times. He's been there for 11 years. Mr. Francis Williams, who was editor of the Daily Herald for 4 years, and for three very eventful years was the Prime Minister's advisor on public relations. Mr. Frederick Coe, who's the London correspondent of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Mr. Alan Pitt Robbins, who's news editor of the London Times, and just the other day, he was a British delegate to the 7th Imperial Press Conference, which was held in Canada. Well, let's go straight away, the four contestants, on this subject. Raymond Daniel, what's your view, really, on the role of the press and the responsibility of it today?
Well, I would say, before answering that I'd like to confine it to the role of the press in a democracy. And I think, with that limitation, we can say that the role of the press is to inform the public of what's going on within the democracy, and insofar as it's able to guide the opinion of the people in a proper direction.
Mr. Williams?
Yes, I think that's so, though I often wonder whether we're not still having a hangover from the past, and that the press tends to think of itself as a guide, philosopher and friend to the great reading public, whereas large sections of the great reading public think of it primarily as an entertainer. I myself think that's a probably inevitable development, although one to be regretted from the point of view of the journalist. And I think the real problem of the press in a democratic society is to find a way of entertaining while at the same time preserving its original and in many ways greater role of guiding and instructing and helping the public to form sensible opinions on national and international matters of importance.
Let's carry this on a bit. Frederick Coe, your idea.
Well, I should say that the press fulfills three functions, or should fulfill them, to tell the truth, to be informative, and to supply entertainment. I think that in the highly competitive world in which we live, the third function, the entertaining aspect, often tends to eclipse the two others. And I think that the best newspapers are those which provide a balance between the three.
Well, Mr. Pitt Robbins?
I agree entirely with that. And I would say that there are three functions: to inform, to educate, and to amuse. And I don't think that the amusement is the least important of the three. I think if you can retain the balance between those three, you're producing a good newspaper.
Well, are we thinking now of the role of the press, or possibly the role of the journalist? And are we thinking of the press, I wonder, as you four gentlemen journalists see it, or as the public sees it?
Well, that was really the distinction that I was trying to make. I think it is quite clear that with the development of popular education over the last quarter of a century or so, and that a large proportion of the new reading public does, in fact, buy its newspaper primarily as an entertainment. It forms its political opinions by other means, as is shown, I think, both by the experience of the presidential elections in the United States and by the experience of our political elections here. That may be because in national affairs, the public feels that it does have other means to form its opinion. And it may well be that in international affairs, the public takes its opinions much more, and perhaps sometimes dangerously so, from the press.
Mr. Robbins?
I think we, as journalists, are rather inclined to overestimate the effect we have on the public. I think they don't take us quite as seriously as we take ourselves. but I think they can be almost unconsciously educated if they're handled the right way.
Have you any views on education, Mr. Daniel?
Well, I was going to say that I think while it's true that the public pays less and less attention to editorial comment in political affairs, that they are guided very, very much by their day-to-day reading of the news that's presented in the news columns. I remember President Roosevelt once said that he didn't mind how much his words were distorted in the editorial page, provided they were printed honestly in the news columns.
Is news printed honestly? What's your view, Cole?
Well, I think it's impossible to answer yes or no to that. I think that the overwhelming majority of journalists, as well as editors, try to print it honestly. I think there is a tendency, especially during heated political periods, occasionally to slant news. You see it particularly during election campaigns. And it's not so much a question of distortion as emphasis, because it's a very simple matter to give great prominence and abnormal amount of space to a candidate with whom your paper is in sympathy, and to subordinate a speech by his rival.
I think it's only fair to say that the restriction on newsprint has made the problem of fair reporting even more difficult than ever, because you cannot always maintain the balance. But I think we do try to give a fair representation to every side of a case. I think in our parliamentary debates, for instance, we try to give both government and opposition a good show, and I should always insist with my reporters that they must bring out both sides of the case, and particularly in the police court case, in both the prosecution and the defence.
Mr. Williamson?
You see, the problem does seem to me to arise from this. The function of the press is undoubtedly to hold up a mirror to the world, to report what happens, some of which is important, some of which is only of fleeting and transitory importance, but of considerable interest. And insofar as it's necessary, to interpret those events and try and put them in their perspective for the ordinary reader. But newspapers do exist as profit-making concerns. Even if they don't wish to make a profit, they must pay their way and be economically self-reliant. And it has been found by experience that those that wish to make large profits are on the whole more likely to do so if they lay greater stress on the entertainment side, on the fleeting transitory side of news, than on the serious news. And also, what is, I think, to some extent even more important and some ways more serious, that if in treating serious news they endeavor to personalize it and dramatize it, to take what not the background of events but the particular goings-on of one particular individual, because names make news and they make readership interest. And therefore that a great many readers of the ordinary popular press do in fact get a very distorted picture of what is happening in the world. A picture which is all foreground and very largely personal foreground, without any of the background which in fact would put that foreground in its proper perspective.
I think that's very much a British statement of a British difficulty. Would either of the Americans here have any views on that?
Well, I would say that in every country there's a good and serious responsible press, and in every country there's a irresponsible press. But surely the people can choose their papers, and I would say that it's better for a person to read a poor newspaper than not to read any at all, because I think in the evolutionary process of education, if he gets in the habit of reading a paper for entertainment, he's a prospective buyer of a serious paper for serious information.
Well, I would say that it's not always a choice between serious news and amusement, but often a conflict between news of historic importance and local news, which is of such popular interest that it helps to sell papers. I remember a case in point which arose in this country last year in connection with alleged corruption in a government department or involving a government department.
for something like 6 weeks. That was the lead story in almost all the papers, including the serious ones. Although at the same time, communist armies in China were conquering the country and bringing about a situation of great historical importance of which we're today feeling the repercussions.
That's a shrewd one anyway. And it brings up a whole new field. Have you any views on that, Mr. Robbins?
No, I don't think so, because I think you must give a great attention to a case like the one which the coup refers to, which was a direct a reflection on the air civil service. It attracted enormous interest because once you raise any question of corruption, the whole, I say, of the British reading public is interested. And I think, therefore, that must come first. And I have no regret for having published 4 or 5 columns a day of those proceedings.
May I just say one Please. Word in reply? I was not suggesting for one moment that that case should have been neglected. I was referring to the proportionate attention that was given to it. And as Robbins says, as much as 5 and even 10 columns a day was given to this case of comparatively local interest, however great its local importance. Whereas day after day you could look in vain for any reference whatever, even for 2 lines in the papers, about events in China.
I'd like, if I may, to take up a point that Daniels made when he said that any reader of a newspaper, however flippant and so on it was a potential reader of a serious newspaper. And that's the sort of thing that I think any serious journalist likes to believe, but I'm not sure that facts bear it out at all. I think many of us believe that just as the in this country, in Britain, the beginning of elementary school education led to the big development of the popular press, so the extension of secondary school education would lead to increased readership for the serious press, or at any rate for the medium serious press. On the contrary, what we have seen is that the papers which have the largest circulations in Britain at the present time are much more flippant and sensational than any papers which existed in the early days of popular journalism, and that it is that which brings the big commercial rewards. And I wonder what is the solution of the problem. Quite clearly, the kind of serious treatment of serious news, which is proper to the Times, whether it be the Times of New York or the Times of London, is unlikely to appeal to a very large section of the public, which is not deeply politically interested all the time, to the extent that readers of those papers may be. Whether we have not to devote ourselves to seeing whether it is not possible to evolve a new technique of dealing with serious affairs, not solemnly, brightly and with interest, but still much more objectively than in many cases they are. And that seems to me one of the big problems for the journalist of today.
Wouldn't that take us, I hope it would take us, into fields of organization as distinct from performance and function? And perhaps we could, for the listener, discuss for a moment or two the organization of our newspapers in both countries, the way in which our setup here is arranged, our national newspapers, which are the 12 big newspapers published here in London, and our local newspapers. Of course, it is different profoundly from the United States, isn't it, where I gather you have quite a different setup.
Very different. For geographical reasons, it's impossible to attain the degree of distribution in the United States that the London papers enjoy. Consequently, metropolitan press of Chicago, New York, and the other large cities dominate their own territory, but do not circulate generally outside of that region. As a result, there are probably more large newspapers scattered through the United States proportionately than there would be in this country.
Do you feel any danger in the United States of what we were alleged to feel here some years ago, a tendency towards monopoly?
Well, I think that is a distinct danger in the United States. We know that
There has been an increasing concentration of ownership of newspapers in chains, and that as a result, a number of papers have folded up, including papers which were desirable additions to journalism.
We've suffered from some extent.
Of course, there has been a tendency in this country to reduce the number of newspapers with the group system. But on the whole, I see no objection to the groups in this country. The one thing I do regret is that it has led to the extinction of certain newspapers in provincial cities, leaving just one paper for an area. I think in every large area of population, there should be at least two newspapers.
I'd like to ask Francis Williams to explain the press council that was recommended by the Royal Commission. Is it supposed to control the press, or how is it supposed to function?
It's not supposed to control the press. It's supposed to be rather a court of appeal to which either the journalist who feels that in the course of his employment he is required by his employers to do things which are contrary to the real role of the press, or also to which a member of the public or an institution or organization which feels that its activities have been not libeled in the strict legal sense, but have been travestied in the press, can appeal, and that the press council would be in a position representing proprietors, leading journalists, and some members of the public, as the Royal Commission proposed, to consider these cases, to issue its judgment on them, and by its existence and by the fact that such cases would be brought up to it, would be able to exercise a restraining influence, shall we say, on the most excessive developments of some sides of modern journalism.
With no punitive powers?
No, I think no punitive powers at all.
I think we ought to make it clear to the listener that at the moment it is entirely proposed that this should be voluntary from the press. But perhaps Mr. Robbins could explain a little more.
Well, there are, of course, different schools of thought on the press council. Some proprietors are completely opposed to it, others and some working journalists favour a press council, provided that the members consist solely of members of the journalistic profession. They do not like the idea of representatives of the public on the commission. I think they would even oppose an independent chairman. They think that a press council composed from the press alone could set its house in order, but of course that is the difficulty which is raised. It would have, as far as I can see, no punitive power. It would have a power to caution people, but of course it has no discipline at all.
I wonder if either Robbins or Williams could tell us the arguments for and against the council briefly.
Mr. Robbins?
That's a very big question, but the argument for the council is that there is need for some kind of body, rather on the lines of the General Medical Council, or even the Bar, the Law Society, which could keep a supervision over the behaviour of the members of the profession. I regard journalism as a profession, and I want to keep that status at that level. The only way I can see that can be done is by a voluntary press council, and personally I think that the newspapers will be well advised to accept something on the lines of a press council rather than take the risk of having it imposed on them. I think it would be much more striking on the part of the newspapers to do it themselves.
I on the whole would agree with that. You see, I feel that in the press, as in many other walks of life, we do have to consider the counterbalances of power. And at the moment, certainly on many papers, the main balance of power is an economic balance of power, in that the newspaper man knows that if he is instructed to do something by his editor, acting, shall we say, either as an editor or in the furtherance of particular ambitions or policies of his proprietor, which he himself thinks run outside the proper responsibilities of a journalist, he knows that if he refuses to do so,
then he may well lose his job, and with a smaller number of papers, and a rather overcrowded profession at the present time, may not be able to find another one. And it's placing a very heavy responsibility indeed upon a newspaper man, who, in addition to being a newspaper man, is probably a family man with a wife and children and so on to support.
But I've been in this business for 25 years, Francis, and worked on half a dozen different newspapers, and never in that entire time have I ever received an instruction to slant a story or distort a story or in any way practice my profession in any way but what I would choose to do myself.
Well, I could vouch for the same experience, but I would like to add that I think that the journalist himself often has the decision, and that we probably have all met the case of the journalist who tries to anticipate the views of the owner of his newspaper and write what he thinks would be welcome to the owner, instead of following a completely independent line and reporting truthfully regardless. So I think the main responsibility there rests with the journalist himself.
I agree.
Mr. Daniel.
Excuse me. I agree. And there's a rather amusing little story I could tell you about that. Covering a political convention one time, I sat next to a man from an agency who asked me what my lead was going to be, and I told him. He said, well, I could never get away with that. He said, I've got to go for the usual old line. He did. His paper used the agency's, another agency story on page one with the same lead that I was sending.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Robbins, as a news editor, have you any views on this?
Yes, I don't think it's so much the slant of a story. I think it is certain newspapers anxious to sell easy copies do occasionally, are guilty of intrusions into, as we call it here, private grief. There have been one or two very bad cases. I'm not sure always whether it's the journalist who is at fault or the photographer. And in fairness to the initial photographers, I think this has happened on more than one occasion by non-journalistic photographers who think that by obtaining a very hurried picture, which is very badly wanted, they're doing a very good piece of work for themselves, not caring anything for the paper in which it appears or for the relatives. I think very often the journalist has been rather maligned over this intrusion of private grief, but I do know of cases where a reporter had been called on to perform a very distasteful task. And I think if there was the Press Council, I think a news editor or editor would think twice on sitting on any assignment like that if he knew that the man had a right of taking his complaint to a higher court.
Yes, I think we've strayed back to technique, and I wonder if we have time just for a moment to consider the press in relation to the international situation as it is today. Our two democratic presses, are they fulfilling their role in regard to the world situation? Mr. Daniel, any views?
Well, I think that in attempting to do that, we're rather handicapped by our inability to get correspondence into the other half of the world. And even when we succeed in getting them in there, they're so circumscribed in their movements and so hemmed in with restrictions that with the best will in the world, it's impossible to give an accurate picture of what's happening there. To that extent, I say we're failing.
Can our newspapers handle, apart from that, which I think is a block we will all admit, are we handling the news that is within our scope effectively and truthfully within the growing Cold War, Williams?
I would say yes. On the whole, I mean, in any profession, and particularly in one which always has time's hurrying feet behind it, like journalism has, where you have to take snap decisions and so on, it's inevitable that from time to time people can quote cases which seem to go the other way. But on the whole, I would say yes, and I would say that both the British and the American press are, on the whole, giving a much better and fuller examination and lead on the current international situation than many of them did on the international situation before the last war. I think for various reasons there has been a fuller attempt to explain differences between the West and the East, always
handicapped by the inability to get the East point of view from an independent reporter. The only problem is, of course, is the old problem to which I referred earlier, that much news, in the eyes of many of the popular papers, only becomes important when it becomes sensational, and so you see the peaks of the international situation without all the valleys and the general land in between, which would give you a more coherent picture.
Yes, I think there's too much of a tendency to treat world news as a sporting event, like a football match.
Yeah,
a succession of dramas.
I would say that the newspapers in this country certainly are really clamoring for real news from behind the Iron Curtain. But we will not take propaganda news or highly censored news. If we could be sure of independent reporting, we would place correspondents in the countries where now it is no use sending men. But we do badly need news, and I think we're, as I say, gasping for news, really effective from behind the curtain.
Mr. Gould?
Well, I should agree that any newspaper reader who wants the Eastern and the Western case should have access to it, that the volume of news published in the West from broadcasts issued from the East, from speeches by Eastern statesmen, politicians, diplomats, and quotations from their press can be offset against the views issuing from our own governments. And any reader who is anxious to do so can form his own judgment without accepting any ready-made view.
Yes, the report from the United Nations are fairly informative.
And, of course, in New York and in London, in each capital, there is at least one newspaper which puts the point of view of the East quite steadily every day. You can pay a penny for it here and buy it. And that seems to me one example of the freedom of the press that we try to practice in both our countries.
Yes.
Mr. Williams?
I don't think that the British and American press, taken by and large, remembering that when you talk about the press, you're really talking about a great many different units, often appealing to quite different levels of public, and therefore inevitably having a different treatment and a different selection of news. But I would say that the press of both countries as a whole are fulfilling their role and their responsibilities fairly adequately at the present time. I think the British press is very much handicapped from fulfilling that role by its shortage of newsprint, by the very small papers which make it impossible to give much of that kind of background which is desirable. When I was in the States last year, I was very much struck by the immense more amount of detailed information you could get from the American press than from the British press, not because of any lacking on the part of British journalists, but simply because of that physical fact.
Thank you, Mr. Williams, and thank you all. I think we've all thrashed round an immensely diverse and varied subject. It seems to me we've flung out ideas for each other, which will probably keep us talking long after the London Forum has ceased. And I hope we've flung out ideas for listeners, which will keep them talking. I don't think we've reached any conclusions at all, but this doesn't seem to me the kind of discussion in which people can reach conclusions. We pose questions, we make rather dogmatic statements, and we leave it to others to argue afterwards.
You've been listening to a discussion in the weekly series London Forum, recorded in a studio of the British Broadcasting Corporation. The speakers were Raymond Daniel, Francis Williams, Frederick Koo, and Alan Pitt Robbins. The chairman was John Connell. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.